The Spirit of Christmas, through the eyes of a paranormal investigator, Rosemary Ellen Guiley, next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back, one of our favorite guests, Rosemary Ellen Guiley, best-selling author, researcher, investigator of the paranormal, metaphysical, and related fields, including afterlife studies and spirit communications, cryptids, alien contact, interdimensional aspects of our extraordinary experiences. She has more than 65 books published, including one with ours called Talking to the Dead, including 9 single-volume encyclopedias and reference works. Her work is translated into 17 languages. And she has worked full-time in the field since 1983. Rosemary has done groundbreaking research on shadow people, the djinn, dark entities causing a variety of haunting and attachment problems as well. Rosemary is the president and owner of Visionary Living, a publishing and media productions company, also the executive editor of Fate magazine. She has served on the boards of various organizations related to consciousness studies and alien contact. And here she is, Rosemary Ellen Guiley. Rosemary, since I'm done with the bio, we're out of time. Good to see you, and we'll talk to you later.
Hey, good night, George.
All right, bye. How are you?
Oh, doing well. It's such a treat to share the holidays again with you.
It's really a special time, isn't it?
It is, and people get so caught up in some of the frenzy. You know, I see some of my friends just very stressed out this time of year, when actually the holiday should be a time for renewal, reflection, some joyous celebrations. We really need to reset the bar, I think, on how we observe Christmas. But Christmas has become such a commercial juggernaut. That may never happen, at least in our society.
Well, that's true. You know, right before you came on, one of our callers, Joe from Boston, he's blind. He's been a regular listener here for, gosh, 16, 17 years at least, said something really poignant. And he said, I'm all alone on the holidays. And I said, Joe, you're not alone because we're going to have our live programming for you, and you can listen to the show, and we're with you. And I think that makes a lot of difference to a lot of people, Rosemary.
It does. The media drills at us mercilessly that we have to be with people at this time of year, and we have to be with family, and everybody has to be happy. And it's no wonder that people who are away from families, or they've lost loved ones recently, or whatever their circumstances, they can't duplicate this model. It's no wonder then that they get depressed or feel isolated.
Christmas is 10 days away. Can you believe that?
It's coming up very fast. You know, the season really does go by very quickly.
I mean, it really does. I mean, the time just buzzes by. It really does. So let's talk about some of the things about Christmas and some of the things you've looked at, including angels, which we'll get into later in the program. But tell us about the modern Christmas customs and what you've been able to uncover.
Right now I'm doing a lot of research in Victorian times, and we get a lot of our customs from the Victorians, but they didn't originate a lot of things. They borrowed from very ancient practices. Interestingly, in America, the kind of Christmas that we celebrate today was virtually unknown in the early 1800s. It wasn't until really more recent times, the 20th century even, that the customs that we do and frankly the mega shopping that we do started to take hold. The Victorians wouldn't have even recognized the Christmas that we celebrate today. But for example, just here in America, let's take a look at the Christmas tree. In the early 1800s, it was an oddity. People regarded it as kind of a pagan custom. And it does go back to pagan times because evergreen symbolizes the renewal of life. The winter solstice is a time for, winter starts turning the clock toward spring. And evergreen boughs represent immortality, everlasting life, the return of the crops. It goes back to Druids, the ancient Romans. And so we have these beliefs incorporated into the Christmas tree. But in the early 1800s, most people didn't have a tree, and they wouldn't have had a tree because they would have considered it very pagan. But German settlers brought Christmas trees with them, and the Germans really put the Christmas tree on the map. And here again, it was from ancient customs that then became coalesced into the tree. The earliest Christmas trees, per se, were just kind of pyramids of wood or wire, even, mm-hmm. that were stuck together with boughs of evergreen branches.
Now, what about Santa Claus? How did Santa Claus pop up? And I've always heard that some people have interpreted Santa as being a mushroom.
Oh, mushroom. Well,
weird, because of the way he looked and the top. And I saw an illustration, and it was bizarre. It really was. I don't know if you ever came across that.
Well, I haven't, but I could certainly see the comparison. But Santa has kind of a checkered history, and you know, we have those little ditties. You know, if you're naughty or nice. If you're nice, Santa will reward you with presents. Well, what's left out of that equation today was that if you were naughty, Santa Claus would do really nasty things to you.
Mm-hmm.
And in earlier times, the Santa Claus figure, who went by different names, was a way of keeping children in check, mind their P's and Q's, their behavior, because if you don't behave, then bad Santa will leave you know, coal for you instead of presents, or will beat you, as elves will come and beat you. And children actually were told these sorts of things. The evil twin of today's Santa is the Krampus figure, which has gotten a lot of revival in recent years, the ugly, almost demonic-looking features of
evil, too, right?
Of the evil twin of Santa. And Santa had elves that would, parents told their children that Santa's elves will beat you if you haven't been good. And so it was a disciplinary thing. And today we we look at Santa as a jolly figure and always happy, and he brings presents. We kind of disregard the bad side.
How did Mrs. Claus pop up into the picture?
I think Mrs. Claus is a recent invention, and we really don't see Mrs. Claus much before the 20th century, and I think that's because of the emphasis on family. Christmas has, since about the 1800s, the 19th century, been oriented around family, and that's what the Victorians did. And one of the reasons why we have the Christmas tree, just getting back to that for a minute, is because Queen Victoria in England married a German, Prince Albert, and his family was used to having a Christmas tree, which got started kind of in the 16th century in Germany. And so the idea was imported into England, and Albert and Victoria made it very much a family thing. They had 9 children, and Christmas was to be observed in a family setting. So these family ideas took hold and carried on and expanded into the 20th century and beyond. And that's where Mrs. Claus comes in. It's because somebody decided at some point, or some advertising people, that Santa Claus had to have a Mrs. There's no Mrs. Claus in the earliest legends about Santa.
During medieval Christmas, is that when they came up with the 12 days of Christmas?
The 12 days of Christmas, yes, go back. The origins go back even earlier than that. And up until the 4th century, Christmas celebrations and even dates were all over the map. And they started to solidify around the 4th century. Christmas Day was set at December 25th. And during medieval times, that would have been from about the 5th century to about the 15th century, the 1400s, Christmas was, it was mostly a religious festival, and you did fasting, you did a lot of masses. There were certainly feasts to be had, and feasting was one of the center points of Christmas, but gift-giving was not a center point of Christmas. The spiritual aspect of it was emphasized. And the 12 days of Christmas Those go from December 25th to 12 days to January 5th, which is the 12th night. And the original purpose of that was to celebrate the nativity of Jesus. And each one of those days had a feast for a saint associated with it. And that's been commercialized, too.
Back to Krampus for a moment. How did that creature get developed?
Well, Krampus goes back to some of the early Santa Claus traditions. I guess you could call him the anti-Santa. We certainly see some of that in the 1800s. And this is where a lot of our present customs start to coalesce from about the 1800s on. Some of the early ones in the 1600s, I would say like the more commercial aspects of Christmas rather than the liturgical and religious views. And here again, it was the idea that the year was coming to an end and you take stock of yourself. And if you were good, there were rewards to be had. And if you were not good, well, there was punishment. And so it was another way for the church actually to have a stick on people.
Wasn't Krampus a half goat, half demon?
Well, that's the way Krampus is portrayed, yes, that the countenance of Krampus is very demonic looking, and the features are very exaggerated in a malevolent sort of evil way. But, you know, some of the depictions of Santa Claus, he's not necessarily unfriendly, but he's not real jolly and friendly either. And there are early 1800s depictions of his bands of elves called Tomtins, which were kind of vampiric, because bad children would be taken to the Tomtins, and the Tomtins would beat them and then lick the blood from their wounds.
Oh, boy.
Now, these are stories that we would never, ever entertain today because our emphasis on Christmas is on the positive.
Let's talk a little bit about the angelic realm, too, Rosemary, as this gets into Christmas. You know, you keep thinking about angels being, you know, helpful and everything else. How did they come into being?
Well, according to the Bible, angels were created as separate beings in the days of creation. And they are separate from human beings. Humans do not become angels after death. And they were set in place to be ministers of everything in creation, to look after everything in the cosmos, the workings of the cosmos. And then when human beings were created after them, then, of course, angels were set in charge over human beings.
And in terms of biblically speaking, the angels, of course, have been around since the beginning of time, haven't they?
Well, angel-like beings certainly have. And if the angel is, in the broadest sense, an intercessor figure between humanity and the Godhead or the gods, and is also a helping figure, because angels are helpers, people have always had these kinds of beings in their mythologies, and they've gone by many different names. But angels were very important in the Hebrew structure of the cosmos, and we get a lot of our beliefs from the early Hebrews, and they borrowed beliefs from other cultures that they came into contact with, especially during their captivities. There's a Zoroastrian influence to angels as well. The Greeks added to that, the Romans. Angels were adopted into Islam, and so that's how the particular being that we call angels evolved over time. And here again, we have a change in view and emphasis, because like the early Santa Clauses, angels weren't always nice to people either. Today we have the view that angels are all benevolent, all helpful. They will always be our champions, and angels do those things. But in biblical times, they were God's messengers and emissaries. They were God's hitmen. And if God was displeased with you, he would send an angel to punish you or warn you. So the appearance of an angel was not always welcomed.
Well, and of course we know about the fallen angels, right?
That was part of the heavenly host that is said to fall from grace with Lucifer over his sin of pride, Lucifer the morning star, and he is cast out of heaven because of his pride, and one third of the heavenly host opt to follow him, and they fall to earth where they become demonic, and then they are condemned to remain in that state and be tormentors.
I always think of angels when I think of the movie It's a Wonderful Life with Jimmy Stewart, where he, you know, was contemplating ending his life, and as he was going to dive into a river, he saw someone screaming for help, drowning, and he jumped in and saved this person, and it was his guardian angel who set him up, basically, to save him, to make him convinced that his worth was worthwhile. And, gosh, I'll always remember that movie. I was a little boy when I first saw it with my mom, Rosemary, and it gave me a perception that, you know, angels were benevolent and helpful, and they were there for all of us. It was an amazing movie. You remember that?
I do, and it's a movie you never get tired of watching, and it's played every Christmas season. It has wonderful lessons for all of us in it. And, of course, it has the mythology in it, too, that whenever a bell rings, an angel gets its wings. And that was popularized by the movie. But I think it really emphasizes the availability of divine help and that in our darkest moments, we have a spiritual shoulder, someone to help us sort things out and see things from a different perspective, and how Clarence goes through that is—it's an amazing process for the viewer.
In your opinion, are angels really real?
Absolutely, George. I've believed in angels all of my life because I had experiences with them when I was a kid, and I just assumed everybody did. And I knew that angels were around me. I could feel them around me. I could hear them singing, and they've always been important to me. Our views of things change over time as we, our cultural views change, our spiritual views changed. And as I mentioned, today we see angels in an all-positive light, and they are spiritual allies. In monotheism, God is very remote. And people need something very personal when it comes to accessing spiritual resources. And that's what the angel provides, because the angel is reflected back to us in our own likeness and provides a reorienting of our spiritual compass, can reawaken within us our spiritual strengths and virtues, and even some admonishment about, how we're living our lives.
You know, Rosemary, back to the fallen angels, let's take the Bible out of it and let's take the religion out of it. What really made them go bad, in your opinion?
Well, actually, we need bad guys. And so if it hadn't been one thing, it would have been another, because we live in a world, a universe, a reality of polarity. There's good, there's evil, there's light, there's dark, there's masculine and feminine. It's a push-pull of these polarities. And if we did not have bad, we would not have something to measure good by. And so we could have bad beings for any reason whatsoever. And if it wouldn't be one thing, there would have to be some other reason to have demonic entities. And they do play a very important purpose in the spiritual evolution of humanity, because as the good angel reflects back to us our strengths, our virtues, our good qualities, the fallen angels reflect back to us our weaknesses.
Hold on, Rosemary. We're going to take a break, but we will be right back. We'll take your calls next hour with Rosemary Ellen Guiley as we talk about the spirit of Christmas and angels. It's that time of year again, isn't it? Her website, visionaryliving.com. One of her books is called The Encyclopedia of Angels. And of course, she also has another one called The Encyclopedia of Demons and Demonology as well. She wrote with us the book called Talking to the Dead, which she did just amazing work on it, to be sure. And welcome back to Coast, Rosemary Ellen Guiley with us as we talk about some of the spirits and traditions of Christmas. Is it true that in Iceland they think of ghosts and trolls during the Christmas season?
It is, George, and we find beliefs like this scattered around the world, actually, that Christmas is a time for evil goblins and trolls to come out and make trouble. And I think they're related to... you know, here again, the dark side of things, that you have to mind yourself, you have to pay attention to your moral P's and Q's, more or less. It's almost Halloween in nature. There are also many customs for observing rituals for the dead at Christmas around the world, too, and that's something we don't do here in America. Meals for the dead, setting places for the dead, visiting cemeteries, and leaving lighted candles. Some of these beliefs go back a long time and extend beyond Iceland as well. For example, in ancient Greece, during this time of year, the evil goblins would be out wreaking havoc. Trolls in Iceland. There's a belief in Iceland as well that folklore belief that if you do not receive new clothes by Christmas Eve, you are in danger of being devoured by a creature called the Yule Cat.
The Yule Cat. Explain that.
Well, the Yule Cat is a cat, literally a cat, and it prowls around and supposedly will eat people if they don't have new clothes on. And it's like the evil trolls and goblins that are out looking for trouble at Christmas time as well. There are all kinds of folklore procedures for keeping these things out of your home other customs as well to keep witches out. Witches are supposed to be out at Christmas as well. This is something that women might appreciate because women usually do the cleaning. In Norway, there is a folk belief that you are not supposed to do any cleaning on Christmas Eve because witches will steal your brooms.
Incredible customs. Something must have happened to these people to come up with these myths and customs, don't you think?
Well, I think a lot of it just goes back to the ancient practices of stock-taking at the end of the year. And, of course, many of these old pagan customs were absorbed into Christianity, and Christianity put an emphasis on morals and taking spiritual stock of yourself, and that if you didn't measure up, if you weren't good, then you were in danger of having something bad happen to you. So Christmas, almost like Halloween, is sort of a liminal period where the veil between the worlds, our world and the spirit world, and even the world of the dead, can be very thin. Now, here in America, where we have commercialized Christmas so much, we don't have those customs or any of those beliefs. They're really rather foreign and alien to us. So our buffers against that liminal area would keep all of these things away. We're so busy focused on what are we going to buy at the shopping mall that it doesn't occur to us that other things might be going on.
Well, absolutely true. Back to the angels for a moment as well, Rosemary. Do you believe that all of us are being watched by guardian angels? Do we all have one attached to us? Or does one handle 100,000 people?
Well, I do believe that we all have guardian angels and that we have an angel literally assigned to us from birth to death. And I believe in reincarnation, so I think it's possible for guardian angels to also accompany us from lifetime to lifetime. But it literally is our personal angel. There are other angels that are available to us throughout life. I think angels come and go as We go through different changes and we have different needs and we need to call on different kinds of spiritual help. But the personal guardian angel is a being that is always with us. And an angel lord has said that angels cannot intercede without permission. When God instructs angels to intercede, that's one matter. But angels aren't just going to step in of their own volition and start sorting things out in our lives. They have to be asked for help. This is emphasized in angel lore over and over again. And so that's why it's important to foster some sort of energetic connection with the angel realm and meditation and prayer, to acknowledge that this very personal spiritual help, which represents the spiritual connection and bridge to the divine, is available to us at all times. At this time of year, when so many people feel left out in many ways, sadly, because of the way Christmas has been over-exaggerated in certain ways, it's more important than ever to have those spiritual connections.
Well, when you say that they don't really step in to help, if for some reason somebody was about ready to get into a car accident, miracles have occurred. And are you saying that the guardian angel didn't do that? Because obviously, right before your accident, you may say, "Oh my God," or something like that, but you know, you're not going to summon an angel up to help you.
Well, actually, we might do the summoning in unconscious ways. And yes, we have these interventions, miraculous interventions, and it's the phenomenon called the mysterious stranger as part of that too, where some unknown person or unknown force appears at the right millisecond and saves the day. So is that an intervention from God or the divine because it's not our time to go yet? I do believe that we go when we're meant to go out of this life. Or do we subconsciously, automatically, and I think we do, this is my belief, in those times of crisis, when you interview people, the first thought that springs to mind when they realize they are in mortal danger is, "God, please help me," or they call out to some spiritual figure for help. And so then what comes in is an angel. What I meant by this other kind of intervention is that as we go through our daily lives, angels are not just going to look over our shoulder and say, "Oh, well, he shouldn't be doing that, so I'm going to fix things." Because we have to ask for that help. And that help then enables us to sort out our issues ourselves.
Well, but with these angels, you know, Christianity has kind of painted a picture that, you know, they're holier than thou, that they were given to us by God. What are they really? Are they a dimensional creature, much like we're a creature in this existence?
They are, by all accounts, beings in their own right. They are non-corporeal. They have no physical body, yet they can take a physical form. So in those respects, they're not too dissimilar from some of the higher beings that contactees encounter today, and lines between higher spiritual beings and angels then become very blurry. So they're forms of energy and light. And when people see angels, if they're not in some sort of manifested physical form, which I think they take on in order to get the job done in certain cases, they are pillars of light. And that's how I usually see angels. When I have had visual perceptions of them, it is of this intense divine light that is so bright you can't even look at it directly. And the angels say that they even step their vibration down when they manifest this way because our senses would just be completely overwhelmed.
What is their main mission? What are they supposed to accomplish here?
The purpose of angels is to act out God's will in creation. And there are different views, however, as to whether or not angels have free will. If they are solely dedicated to acting out God's will, then they have no free will. And yet, we have contradictions to that because they do things like make their own decisions about how they're going to behave, which is a free will choice. And those stories have been around since ancient times as well. But their primary purpose is to help hold things together. They look after everything in creation, the stars, the space, the planets, all life forms on Earth, everything that would be on this Earth, including every blade of grass, every piece of foliage, every grain of sand, would be ministered by the angelic realm. And so they're part of the glue that holds everything together. And I think also their other important function is to provide this pathway to the Godhead to access higher levels of spiritual energy and inspiration that human beings might need help finding their way to.
Could they be from other planetary systems?
They certainly could. And arguments have been made in ancient aliens theories that the beings that we call angels might have even been extraterrestrials coming to visit
yes.
Earth. And they have.
I could see that. I could see that.
You know, these shining kinds of manifestations. They seem to come from the heavens, from the skies. They have superpowers. And
chariots of the gods, as Eric von Däniken would say.
Absolutely. And then when you look at the beings that people have interacted with throughout history, trying to put definitive black and white lines around them, it gets very difficult.
Well, it sure does. Now, let's talk about miracles for a moment. It is Christmas time. What makes those occur?
A miracle technically is an extraordinary act that cannot be explained naturally. And in a religious sense, miracles are a divine favor, part of the covenant that God establishes with humanity. And they are a demonstration of the power of God and the fellowship that humanity enjoys with God. But miracles can have a much broader definition, too. And from an Eastern mysticism perspective, miracles are part of the natural order. They're just extraordinary events. And we are capable of actually bringing miracles into manifestation. We don't have to wait for them to be visited. In the Western view, people are the recipients of God's grace in the form of miracles. God decides when there's going to be a miracle. In other views, including the Eastern views, the miraculous is ongoing in the world. It's part of reality, part of the natural world. And you can participate in this energy by spiritualizing your consciousness so that you then start to realize a different kind of even synchronicity, you might put it, that events take on a different energy in your life. The miraculous can happen, but it's a concert. It's not that people become gods and start doing miraculous things. It's in concert with spiritual and divine energies that are around us all the time.
Who manifests the miracle? The individual, you, me, or some other entity?
I believe that it's a process of co-creation. And even from the Western view, where people are more the passive recipients of miracles, there still has to be something generated within us for the miracle to take place. There's a need for one thing. And that could be a spiritual need, a crisis need, something to an outworking that needs to be extraordinary. So there is a need, and that sets a process in motion. And we can align ourselves with the divine forces in motion to bring about extraordinary changes in circumstances. The more attention that we pay to the state of our consciousness and how we are thinking, because in all mystical traditions, thought manifests reality, then we can understand the energy of miracles much better.
Well, I got to tell you, it works. I mean, there's no doubt in my mind that miracles occur, they happen, and they do some marvelous things for a lot of people. Would you agree?
I do agree. And of course, having some spiritual underpinnings to your life, prayer and meditation, these are very important ways to fertilize that evolution and expansion of consciousness that brings us into greater contact with those forces, the miraculous forces, the having more interactions with the angelic realm, a greater cosmic consciousness, so to speak. And it can start with just a few minutes of meditation or prayer a day.
And how much concentration do you have in order for these things to occur? How much meditation?
You mean in terms of like wanting a certain miracle to happen?
Yeah, I mean, do you have to really concentrate on it?
I believe that it depends on the unique circumstances of the event. Because there are some miracles, like, for example, miracles of healing, where you might be up against some very formidable odds. And so you might engage in a lot of intense prayer for that purpose. And we have to act for ourselves, too. And so we take other actions that enhance the chances for some miracle to take place. People do have to realize that not everything can be solved by a miracle. And sometimes, as hard as it is, there are experiences that we have to go through for some other purpose. And life is it's a constant play of forces in motion, if you want to look at it from a quantum perspective.
Sure is. Rosemary, going to take a break, but let's come back with phone calls next on Coast to Coast AM.